Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Just before 9 a.m. on December 5th, 2015, a SWAT team was hovering outside the Eagle Nation Cycle Shop in Neenah, Wisconsin. Dispatch was giving them intel on where their suspect was inside the building.
There are one, everyone who just been advised he is in the back of the building again. He's by the workbench in the back of the building.
Just minutes earlier, the Neenah Police Department had responded to the area after receiving calls that there was a man with a gun inside, and he had an unknown amount of hostages inside with him.
And what information was that you were provided regarding the countdown?
Dispatch advised us that they were receiving information that there was a 5-minute countdown. If the subject inside didn't get what he wanted, he was going to start shooting people.
The SWAT team, also referred to as a hasty team, didn't have much time to act. They were down to 1 minute from when the hostage taker said he would start firing. They quickly crept through the alley to the rear door of the building. The door was unlocked, and so they entered. There were 5 officers as part of the team. Lieutenant Ty Thompson in the front, followed by Lieutenant Sean Obrey, Officer Craig Hoffer, Officer John Kufel, and Officer Robert Ross. As soon as they entered, they saw 2 men, whom they shouted at to get down. The 2 lead officers, Lieutenant Thompson and Lieutenant Obrey, weren't able to see very well, having just entered a darkly lit building from the bright outdoors, and so they didn't notice a stairwell to their immediate right. Both men tumbled down the stairs, leaving the remaining 3 officers in the doorway. It was just seconds later when gunfire erupted. The hostage taker was shooting at them, and so they hurriedly fired back, striking a fire extinguisher, which sent smoke and dust throughout, making it even more difficult to see. All 5 officers were able to retreat out of the building. One of them, Officer Craig Hoffer, had been hit. Another officer, Sergeant Angela Eichmann, tended to him. The bullet had pierced Officer Hoffer's helmet, but he was otherwise okay. Nevertheless, Sergeant Eichmann wouldn't let him go back.
We got enough guys there.
No, we don't. Have enough fucking guys, okay?
You know you can't go back there right now. They're tight.
The remaining members of the Hasty team gathered together to discuss next steps as they watched the rear door for any other activity. Lieutenant Ty Thompson called out to the hostage taker to try and engage him. The response was more gunfire coming from inside. Officer Kufel, the SWAT team leader, said, "I don't think they're hostages." He and the other officers would later testify that at that point, they were getting the feeling that this was all a setup and that they were perhaps being ambushed. Sergeant Eichmann was standing with Officer Ross and Officer Hoffer when they heard more gunfire, and seconds later, saw a man running out of the building. The man crouched behind a truck that was parked in the alley. He was armed with a gun and was moving around and seemed to be pointing it towards the door of Eagle Nation. "That's him," Sergeant Eichmann called out. Officer Hoffer and Officer Ross both fired their guns at the man, and he immediately fell to the ground. Sergeant Eichmann, Officer Ross, and Officer Hoffer maintained their positions and on their body cameras could be heard saying that they believed he was the shooter, that they had got him. Suspect down, Sergeant Eichmann said. But just 12 seconds later, they would hear a disturbing update from dispatch. Quote, the shooter's still inside. It would turn out they hadn't killed the hostage taker at all. They had just shot and killed a hostage. It would take another couple hours for the standoff to end, but eventually the other hostages were released and the hostage taker, 46-year-old Brian Flatoff, surrendered and was taken into custody. There were many things about this situation that at first were unknown. Who was Brian Flatoff and why had he taken hostages at the Eagle Nation cycle shop? Why had the officers shot and killed one of the hostages? And perhaps more importantly, in hindsight, who would be legally responsible for the hostage's death? This is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie, episode 110. The hostage who lost his life that day was 60-year-old Michael L. Funk. He was known as ML to his family and friends, including his wife and daughter. He reportedly had a passion for motorcycles and was co-owner of Eagle Nation Cycles when he was killed. Brian Flatoff was taken into custody and brought to the hospital, where he was interviewed by special agents who had taken over the case. They would later note in their report that Brian at first did not appear to recollect the incident. But as the interview went on, he did recall having a gun, being at Eagle Nation, and wanting to kill a former friend of his, Vance Dalton, with whom he had had a dispute over his motorcycle. Brian was initially held in custody on the charge of first-degree recklessly endangering safety with a firearm. Meanwhile, the Wisconsin Department of Justice, which had taken over the investigation from the Neenah Police Department, was looking into exactly how Michael Funk had died. Three Neenah police officers were placed on administrative leave while they awaited the Department of Justice's conclusions. The investigation continued for about 5 months before an official announcement was made. No charges would be filed against the officers. According to news reports, many in Neenah were surprised and had expected that the officers would be charged. One resident called it heartbreaking, while another said it was totally disappointing, telling reporters, "This is just absurd." Attorney General Brad Schimmel held a press conference explaining the findings. He said the officers were justified based on their perceived threat of imminent death or great bodily harm to themselves or others. He said their observations upon entry into the shop indicated a setup rather than a hostage situation.
Because a reasonable person could come to the conclusions they came to, we would not be able to prove a case beyond a reasonable doubt and that the officers acted in reasonable self-defense under Wisconsin law.
According to the Department of Justice's report, they interviewed more than 60 people and went through hours of surveillance footage before reaching their conclusion. Quote, there is no question that officers Ross and Hoffer intentionally shot and killed Michael Funk on December 5th, 2015. The evidence also establishes that they did not recognize the man they shot. They saw the man with a gun in his hand turning towards them, and they believed the man was the armed hostage taker and posed an imminent threat of death or great bodily harm. Wisconsin acknowledges privilege as a defense to otherwise criminal conduct where a privilege held by statute, in this case, self-defense, exists. It further states, quote, because the evidence establishes that officers Hoffer and Ross believed Mr. Funk was in fact the armed hostage taker and was scoping for targets with his handgun as he turned towards them in the alleyway, any criminal charge against them would be countered with the affirmative defense. Also among their findings were that officers fired 19 shots in that alleyway, and that after Michael Funk was shot, they yelled, Show your hands. The report also stated that it took 45 minutes for Michael Funk's body to be removed and taken to the hospital. They noted in conclusion that the state would not be able to convince a jury beyond a reasonable doubt, and that the violence and terror of that day was set in motion by Brian Flatoff. In a jailhouse interview with USA Today's network in Wisconsin, Brian said he was wrong for going into the motorcycle shop that day and for opening fire, but he said he is not responsible for Michael Funk's death. He also said that what he did that day is completely out of character for him, and that he believes he suffers from a mental illness which causes blackouts. He recalled waking up in the hospital on that day, surrounded by officers. He said he asked, "Now what the hell did I do?" Under Wisconsin law, someone can be charged with felony murder if they cause someone's death during the commission of a felony. So even though Brian Flatoff didn't directly shoot and kill his hostage himself, he could still be charged for the murder. And he was. Brian Flatoff was charged with 16 felony charges, including felony murder. Brian pleaded not guilty, and not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect, to all charges. But his trial was delayed again and again. He went through 10 public defenders before finally requesting to represent himself. Ben Salaji, a standby counsel, was assigned to sit next to him at the defense table and provide assistance if needed. But other than that, Brian would be cross-examining witnesses, making objections, and presenting his own case by himself. In his opening statements, Deputy District Attorney Scott Seaman told the jury what had led up to the hostage situation in the first place. He said it was over a dispute about a motorcycle. He noted that in August of 2015, 4 months prior to the incident, Brian was arrested for a felony offense in a different county. Afterwards, he contacted an acquaintance of his named Vance Dalton to see if he could post his $3,000 bond. Brian and Vance negotiated and agreed to take Brian's motorcycle and put it up for collateral on a loan. Vance then went and got a loan for $4,500. He put $3,000 as bond and gave Brian the rest. In turn, Brian signed over the title to his motorcycle. Prosecutor Seaman told the jury that no matter what testimony they hear, this is not a trial about who owns that motorcycle. That's only relevant as to why, on the morning of December 5th, 2015, Brian armed himself with a 9mm pistol and two 33-round full magazines. In October 2015, Prosecutor Seaman said Brian sent Vance letters and called him multiple times, demanding his motorcycle back. Vance told him that if he could put up the money for it, he could have it back. But the phone calls became threatening. And finally, on December 5th, Vance was at home cooking breakfast for his kids when his friend Ryan Motorson called him. Brian had gone into Eagle Nation's cycle shop, armed with a gun, and ordered Ryan to get Vance to come down there.
Brian Flatoff had come to retrieve his motorcycle, but at this point, that wasn't enough. He also had come to kill Vance Dalton.
Ryan Motorson tipped off Vance on the phone, and so Vance called 911. Prosecutor Seaman explained how 5 officers formed the Hasty team and went inside the building, how the first 2 officers fell down the stairs, and how Officer Hoffer was shot in his helmet. Then Prosecutor Seaman told the jury that Michael Funk ran out the back door, and Brian shot 5 rounds at him as he escaped. Officers heard those gunshots and saw Michael crouched behind a pickup truck with a firearm. He said Michael turned to start running towards the officers when they opened fire, shooting and killing him. After a 3-hour standoff, Brian eventually released the other hostages and laid down his firearm and surrendered to police. He was taken to the hospital for observation, where he confessed to officers. Prosecutor Seaman told the jury that Michael Funk's death was Brian Flatoff's fault. When it was his turn to give his opening statements, Brian Flatoff wanted to make a statement first.
One of the things, I think before I read my statement, I want to let you know that if you see me get emotional or something like that, it's not... I'm diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder.
Objection, Your Honor. This is not anything admitted into evidence or relevant towards phase one.
Right. Mr. Flatoff, let's not get into your medical diagnosis. That is a phase two type of thing, okay?
Yes, Your Honor.
Brian told the court that the DA left out a lot of facts in the case. He said, it's a really nice story he told you, but it should be marked up as fantasy. He then read his opening statement from a piece of paper.
I have come here today representing myself to tell you the truth. Even the public defenders assigned to this case weren't willing to tell you. I plan to show you police corruption never seen before, though I suspect that everything else will be blocked from use. This is a deadly serious trial. One person already paid with his life, gunned down execution style by police sworn to protect you. I would compare it to 19 Spanish officers and a firing squad standing a man against the wall and pulling the trigger 19 times in the back. I am without warning. I am going to show you the person killed at a $50 million federal lawsuit against the police that shot at him 19 times. Then they said, fuck that, let him lay there and die, instead of helping him, followed by laughter, bragging, and cover-ups. Bragging, saying that he got one right between the eyes, ha ha ha. So inappropriate, it'll make you have chills. You will not forget the video you see in this case.
According to the New York Daily News, the lawsuit Brian was referring to here is one Michael Funk and the other co-owner of Eagle Nation, Steve Arado, brought against the Neenah Police Department a couple years prior, and that was still pending. In the suit, they alleged that police officers wrongfully raided Eagle Nation with excessive force in 2012. Investigators had reportedly believed that they were busting a heroin deal in the alley. However, only 0.9 grams of marijuana was reportedly found in the shop's office. Brian told the jury that this case makes him so angry, and he said he doesn't even remember the details of that day.
I came here to prove to you, tell you the truth, not be a nice guy and sugarcoat this disgusting outrage. I don't actually remember December 5th, 2015. All that I know, I have in these boxes with me. All this I have had to study every day for 2.5 years.
Common sense will show you I had no choice, he said.
Usually in court, the prosecutor here has the truth on his side. Things are clearly cut and dry. In this case, lies, half-truths, manipulations, and corruption is on the prosecutor's side. I will prove this to you.
He said there are too many lies to address, and that the evidence will show the shocking truth. Eva Kransky was the state's first witness. She testified that she was in a relationship with Brian until the end of July 2015, but that they remained friends. Towards the end of October, she said Brian told her that the title of his motorcycle had been forged by Vance Dalton, and that he was very upset about it. Then, at about 9:45 p.m. on December 4th, the day before the incident, she picked Brian up from a friend's house. He seemed drunk, she said. She tried to take him to his brother's house, but his brother didn't answer the door. By this time, Brian had fallen asleep in the car. She took him back to her house, parked in the garage, put the passenger seat down, and then put a blanket over him. She stayed there in the garage with him. At 4 a.m., she said he got out of the vehicle and fell flat on his face. She took him inside after a few more falls and him hitting his head again. She said she kept trying to find out where he was bleeding from. She thinks it was his nose. She was concerned about him having a concussion or worse. After about 7 a.m., he started talking to her about wanting to go down to Eagle Nation and talk to Vance.
He just said that he knew that he would be there. and wanted to go speak with him. And I told him it was way too early for anyone to be around because he had no sense of time. And he just kept saying, no, someone will be around. I just want to go talk to him. I just want to go talk to him. It'll be okay. And at this point, I was tired. I was mad at him for drinking. So I said, fine. Do what you're going to do.
He reassured her that he was calm, that he just wanted to talk to Vance. He told her that he would be back in a half hour. When he left, she fell asleep. She woke up at about 9 a.m. Her friend called to tell her that something may be happening at Eagle Nation and to check on Brian. She told him that she was sure everything was going to be okay. A few minutes later, he called back and told her, "Something really bad is happening. You need to go find him." She quickly got dressed, grabbed her keys, and on her way out, she saw an open gun case on the table. She said the gun case had been behind a chair and underneath some bags. She ran out, got into her Jeep, and flew to Eagle Nation. She said she jumped out, grabbed an officer, and told him very quickly who was there, what he was wearing, and that he was suicidal. On cross, Brian got up from the defense table and said, "Oh, where to start this?" He asked her if she recalled what she told investigators. She said yes. She told them everything she had just testified to, and also that he had been ordered to be with her 24/7 because they were awaiting an emergency psychiatric appointment for him. The prosecutor objected.
At this point in time, there's no foundation for this.
It's in the paperwork.
It's not relevant to phase one.
All right, so that objection is sustained. That's not relevant at this point. And Ms. Lawson, prosecutor, if someone objects, let me listen to the argument, and then I'll rule and make the decision, okay? You understand?
Sure.
Okay.
Brian asked her if she knows for sure that her gun went missing on that date, or if it could have gone missing at another time. She said she hadn't seen it for years, so she couldn't say for sure. Brian told the judge that there were discrepancies with what Eva told the Department of Justice attorneys when they interviewed her on video and what they then wrote in their report. He asked Eva if she had ever read their report, and she said no. She wasn't aware that she was even giving them a report or a statement. She said they were asking her what she thought were ridiculous questions, and she was trying to answer them with explanations, but that they didn't want to hear them. Brian then asked her to forgive him. He was trying to figure something out. "Perhaps you could reserve the right to call me at a later date," she said. The judge then admonished her and told her that she couldn't give him legal advice while he was presenting his case. A friend of Brian's testified that he talked to him around 9 a.m. that morning. Brian told him that he wasn't going to be taken alive.
What else did, if anything, did Brian Flatoff say regarding if the police were outside?
He just said that he wasn't going to be taken alive, that there would be a lot of people getting killed.
Vance Dalton also testified for the state. He said he and Brian used to be friends, that he had known him for quite a long time. In late August 2015, Brian had been arrested for drinking and driving, and he contacted Vance to help him post bond. Vance said they came to an arrangement that Brian would sell him his motorcycle, which he did. Vance took out a loan to purchase it and gave the court $3,000 and Brian the rest. Then, in October, he started getting threatening phone calls from Brian.
And how did it progress from there?
Threats against myself, threats against my children, threats against my wife.
Was he calling you with these threats?
Absolutely.
And what, if anything, specifically would he call and say to you?
He said, "If I don't get my bike back, I'm going to kill you. I'll kill your kids. I'll kill your wife to get to you."
He said he received a lot of calls. In November 2015, he testified that he wrote a letter to the judge from Brian's drinking and driving case. He wrote that he posted the bond on the premise that Brian would get help and change, but that he is not. He said he hopes the court takes this letter into consideration when Brian inevitably violates his bond. He wrote that he was worried that he would lose his money, but that more importantly, he was worried about Brian hurting someone. I wish I could just revoke the bond, he wrote. Vance also recalled a Facebook post Brian had written and that was shared on his page, where Brian wrote, "Never fuck with a psychotic motherfucker. I am going to enjoy your suffering and pain. You have no idea what the hell is coming. The best you can do is repent and make shit right." On the morning of December 5th, 2015, Vance said he was cooking his kids breakfast when Ryan Motorson, a very good friend of his, called him and told him that he needed to come down to the shop. He told Ryan that he would be there shortly. Ryan then told him, "Don't come down here. Call 911. Brian's here with a gun." He could hear Brian in the background.
And what, if anything, could you hear Brian Flatoff saying in the background?
"If you don't get him down here, I'm going to kill you all."
He called 911 and relayed to the dispatcher what he was hearing. He said he heard Brian say that if Vance doesn't show up in 5 minutes, he'll kill everyone in the building.
Now, at some point while you're on open line with Ryan Motorson and with 911, did you hear anything similar to gunshots?
Yes.
And do you recall approximately how many gunshots?
A lot.
On cross-examination, Vance was asked how many times he has been convicted of a crime. He said 7. Jonathan Kufel was the SWAT team leader for the Neenah Police Department. He testified that dispatch had radioed that the subject at Eagle Nation said that if someone didn't show up there in 5 minutes, he would start killing people, and so he raced over to the scene. He said that due to the countdown, they didn't have time for their normal protocols, which would include looking at a floor plan, getting info about the hostages, etc. As he and 4 others who were part of his Hasty team entered Eagle Nation's rear door, they called out that they were the police. He said there were a lot of motorcycle parts and tools in their way. He saw 2 individuals standing there, and he yelled, "Police, hands, get down on the ground." He testified that the 2 individuals just stared at them in surprise. There was no reaction. He said the next thing he knew, all hell broke loose, and gunfire rang out at them. He heard Officer Hoffer yell out that he had been hit.
"Yeah, as I was starting to feel, I felt that it was all happening very fast. I heard the gunfire, felt the gunfire. I looked down. Officer Hoffer was yelling, I'm hit. I looked down. My other 2 guys, Lieutenant Thompson and Obrey, were gone. I had no idea where they went. They weren't standing up. I was basically standing by myself. Officer Hoffer was to my right, leaning on the ground, grabbing his head, saying he was hit. At that point, I feared for my life and the rest of my teammates, so I used target-specific directed fire."
He yelled out that Hoffer's been hit. Let's get out of here. His gunfire hit a fire extinguisher and created a plume of smoke while he backed out of the door. Hoffer had crawled outside, and he stayed in the threshold while another round of gunfire was fired at them. Officer Kufel leaned back in and fired back. As he did that, Lieutenants Obrey and Thompson came up from the stairs and were able to exit too. After another round of gunfire came at them while they were outside, he said he exclaimed, "Those aren't no fucking hostages." They then did a withdrawal back to the opposite end of the alley. He didn't see Michael Funk get shot, but did hear the gunfire. On cross-examination, Brian asked Officer Kufel if he was wearing a body camera that day, and he said no. Brian then tried to ask him if he was part of a 2012 drug raid at Eagle Nation, but the judge ruled it wasn't relevant. He called for the jury to step outside. And then the judge asked Brian to explain why he thought it was relevant. Brian said the police have a history going back to 2011, where they referred to Eagle Nation as an outlaw motorcycle club. He said there were many references to gang activity, heroin sales, weapons, and even a police assassination plot against the police department. Brian then consulted with his side counsel and said it also goes towards the felony murder charge, and that the officers were trigger happy. He also noted that the potential fear of this gang and recorded assassination plots could have given them a heightened awareness when responding to the scene. The state objected to Brian bringing this up in front of the jury, saying they weren't given proper notice. But the judge said he would allow Brian to go very briefly into the area, but not to get too specific. When the jury came back into the courtroom, Brian asked Officer Kufel if he had a heightened awareness of the Eagle Nation location when he went there. Officer Kufel responded that he was going into a hostage situation and that it doesn't get much more heightened than that. He said the situation was rapidly evolving and that he didn't have time to dwell on the past. Lieutenant Sean O'Bray took the stand next. He described making entry into Eagle Nation with the other members of the Hasty team.
At that time, Lieutenant Thompson opened the door. We stepped in. My first impression that it was dark inside. I think what was happening is we're getting a lot of reflection off from the sunlight off the shield into our eyes. I observed one subject who appeared to be non-threatening, just standing there with his arms by his side. And the next thing that I knew, that everything went black, and I had a sense of falling.
And what caused that sense of falling?
Apparently, as Officer Thompson had moved right and we were trying to create an opening for the team to get through, there was a very steep set of stairs there, and we both went tumbling down the stairs.
He was back on his feet and starting to come up the stairs when he heard gunshots. He recalled hearing Officer Hoffer scream that he had been hit. He heard Lieutenant Thompson whisper, "Get down." He looked to his right and realized that his head was above the concrete floor and he was at risk of being hit, so he lowered himself. He then saw Officer Kufel returning fire and knew it was his opportunity to escape. He crawled out through the doorway. He testified that once they were all outside, he heard Officer Kufel say, "They don't appear to be hostages. Something's not right here." He said he was now thinking that they had been ambushed due to the violence of the attack, combined with what Officer Kufel said. He said he heard two more rounds of gunfire. One sounded like it was coming from inside Eagle Nation, and the other round sounded distinctly different, as though it was coming from outside. He said eventually an armored vehicle showed up, and he could see a body in the alley. On cross-examination, Lieutenant O'Bray said he did have a heightened awareness due to his past experience with that location. He was asked if there were any active investigations involving Eagle Nation at the time of the shooting, and he said there may have been. Officer Robert Ross was one of the officers who shot Michael Funk. He testified about why he fired his gun.
Now, who did you believe this person was as he started to turn towards you?
I believe it was the individual that was inside shooting us.
Why did you decide to shoot at that point?
I felt there was an immediate threat to those, myself, the other officers around me, the people in the vicinity. There's a lot of people in the area, including those that were in Vicky's itself. We had just received gunfire from inside the shop, so we had a weapon, obviously, in his hand. There was intent where we just received gunfire inside, where we'd been shot at. And then the delivery system, we were taught through the state, he had the ability to shoot us from where he was at because of the proximity.
After he shot him, he said the man went to the ground. They radioed out that they had engaged the subject, and he was down in the back alley. On cross, Brian asked him about inconsistencies in his statement versus what can be heard on his body camera.
In your statement to the Department of Justice, you say that you've seen Michael Funk with a gun. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
Is there any reason why your body camera would say that you didn't process a gun? You just processed the shot, that you didn't see a gun?
Sorry?
In prior testimony, you said you did state that you viewed your body camera evidence?
Correct.
And anywhere in your body camera evidence did you state that you didn't process a gun? You just processed the shot?
I'm not entirely certain.
Brian asked the court to play his body camera footage again, which had originally been played for the jury on direct. After viewing it, Officer Ross agreed that he could be heard on the footage saying that he wasn't able to fully process a gun. But he told the court that he did see a weapon. Brian again played a point in the body camera footage where he said, "I was looking for a gun, but I heard a shot." Hearing the shot is what caused you to open fire, is it not? Brian asked. Yes, I believed that first shot was coming from the subject, Officer Ross responded. And that's what prompted me to act.
How long do you think you had to identify that threat that day?
Maybe seconds.
If I told you it was 1 second, would you believe me?
Probably.
And in 1 second, you processed the threat and pulled the trigger?
Correct. As best as I could.
Brian then asked him if after he shot Michael Funk, did he have any concern for the person shot being a potential victim? Was he concerned that he had just shot another human being?
Absolutely, I was very concerned that I was just involved in an officer involved shooting where I shot another human being.
Brian then played a part on the body camera footage where someone could be heard saying they couldn't care less right now. Brian asked if that was consistent with him being concerned. The prosecutor objected and the judge ruled that Officer Ross's feelings after the event weren't relevant to the case. Brian asked if Officer Ross recalled another person exiting the building after ML was shot. Officer Ross said yes and said he gave commands to him. Brian pointed out that in the span of just 30 seconds, he gave out 21 commands to that person. But when Michael Funk came out, he was given no commands. Also under cross-examination, Officer Ross told the jury that he fired a last 2 shots at Michael as he continued to move on the ground. He said he still viewed him as a threat. Sergeant Angie Eichmann testified about what she was thinking when she first saw Michael Funk run out of the building. She said she believed he was their suspect.
What did you do or say once you observed this person come out the back door?
I said this is him because I would think a hostage would have ran away and he didn't. And he had long hair.
And was that one of the physical characteristics that you've been provided of the hostage taker?
Yes.
So what did you observe the person do after you ran out the back door?
There was a truck back there, and he was hanging around the truck and kind of swaying back and forth, looking towards the door. I couldn't figure out who he was or what he was doing.
And what happened next?
Officer Hopper and Officer Ross had come up on either side of me. And at that time, I could not see the person had come out anymore. And then both officers were firing.
She said the man then fell to the ground and wasn't moving. Eventually, an armored vehicle came in to get him. He had not moved or responded to commands, so she knew he was deceased. She later learned who he was. On cross, Brian asked her if anyone had commented that Michael had a gun before he was shot, and she said yes, although she wasn't sure if it was Officer Hoffer or Officer Ross. She was asked if she saw a gun, and she said no. Brian asked her if she remembered saying something on the body cam video. Quote, because he was hiding behind the truck, so it wasn't like a, my impression is it was a victim trying to run away. He pointed out that in her testimony, she was saying she thought he was the suspect. Sergeant Eichmann told him that she couldn't understand exactly what she was saying in the body camera footage, so she isn't sure. Brian asked the judge if he could play the footage again. But she said it wouldn't help because people were talking over her in the footage itself, making it impossible to make out what she had said. The judge ruled that it wouldn't be played again. When asked if she had a heightened alert when responding to the scene due to prior contact or knowledge of Eagle Nation, she said she never had contact with anyone there personally. She said she didn't fire because she had lost sight of the subject and couldn't see him anymore. Lieutenant Ty Thompson was the final officer to testify. He described how they came up with a plan to use an armored vehicle, or Bearcat, to safely remove the body from the alley.
We backed the Bearcat so that we had the door covered in case anyone else would come out that door. We had that door covered. And there was a subject lying on the ground. As we got closer, I could see in his hand there is a handgun. It appeared to be a very nice, like a Kimber semi-auto, .45 caliber. In his right hand, his finger was still on the trigger, and that was outstretched in his hand. His hand was kind of down. This hand was up as he's laying on the ground.
He said he removed the gun from the man's hand, picked him up, and got him in the back of the armored vehicle. He didn't see much blood on him. While he was calling for an ambulance, He heard on dispatch that they were still negotiating with the hostage taker.
And then we're still listening on a radio and we heard there's some communication. They're still negotiating with the hostage taker. That totally threw me off guard because at that point I didn't know. I thought we had the hostage taker with us right now.
You thought that was the body you recovered from the alley?
Correct.
The state also called two of the hostages to testify on the stand about what they experienced when Brian came into Eagle Nation. Michael Peterson goes by Old Mike. He lives behind Eagle Nation and used to go there every Saturday to have coffee and breakfast with the guys there. He said he has known ML for 15 years and that they were friends. When he walked in that morning, he saw Ryan Motorson working on a motorcycle. He said good morning to him, as he always did. He said he didn't catch it at the time, but Ryan mumbled something back to him. He later found out that it was, "Get the hell out of here." It wasn't like Ryan to not say good morning back to him, but he brushed it off, thinking maybe Ryan was just having a bad day. He then saw ML sitting down, with a man he didn't know standing behind him. He said ML was motioning to him with his eyes, but he didn't know what that was about. He thought maybe he wasn't having a good day either.
So what happened next?
Then a fellow was standing behind him, and he said something to the effect about, get the hell out of here.
You said you should get the hell out of here, or you were going to?
He did.
Okay.
The fellow did to me. And I never saw him before, so I didn't know him. And usually everybody was in such good humor when I'd go over there. I thought he was joking around. So I said to him, I'm not ready to leave yet.
What happened next?
He pulled a gun out from under a Levi jacket, I believe he had on it. He says, you think I'm joking? I said, no.
Did he appear serious?
Yeah, serious enough to get my attention.
He said he told him, yeah, I think it's time for me to leave. And the man responded, you're not going anywhere now. He followed the man's direction and walked over to the counter and sat down. When asked how Michael Funk looked, he said he looked scared. There was no doubt about it. The man had a gun and a couple hunting knives. He overheard him say to ML, you think these are sharp enough to cut someone's arms off? ML stuttered and said, yeah. At some point, the rear door opened. He remembered seeing a shield and then heard, get on the floor, drop your gun. He got on the floor and lied flat under a table. Within seconds, shooting started. He was asked who fired first, and he said he would say the defendant. He heard Brian tell ML to close the back door, and then he heard more shooting coming from outside. He then heard Brian on the phone with police, and then Brian eventually told them to get the fuck out. Ryan came over to help him up, and they walked out the back door. On cross, Brian asked him if he recalled him saying that if Vance doesn't get there in 5 minutes, he's going to kill them all.
I've heard that comment, but I do not distinctly remember you saying that day.
Do you remember me ever yelling that if Vance ain't here in 1 minute, I'm going to start killing all of you?
No, I do not remember that.
Do you ever remember me screaming specifically that I'm going to kill Vance Dalton and his wife and kids?
No, not specifically. I do not.
He testified that afterwards he was handcuffed and put in the back of a squad car for 3 hours. They then questioned him at the police station. Brian pointed out that in that interview, he never told police that Brian fired his weapons at police first. He also never said anything about Brian talking about cutting off people's arms. Mike explained that he had just been through one hell of a situation and was answering their questions the best he could at the time. Another hostage, Ryan Motorson, described his ordeal. He said he got to work that morning and was hanging out and talking to ML. He had just given him a Christmas card. He said they were chatting like normal when they heard a car pull up in the back. That was pretty unusual, he said, because they typically knew who was coming to the store. He went to work on his motorcycle, while ML went to the back to see who it was.
I was working on a motorcycle, and I noticed he came through the door, and that's when I saw Mr. Flatoff come through the door with him, and ML kind of looked at me and kind of gave me a look of...
You go ahead and say it.
Yeah, like, we're fucked. So, and that's when I saw he had, Mr. Flatoff had a pistol in his waist, and I kind of walked to the end of the lift and kind of met up with ML and him as they were walking toward the desk.
He had never seen Brian Flatoff before. Video footage from inside Eagle Nation was shown to the jury as Ryan narrated. You can clearly see ML and Brian walk back inside. A gun is visible in Brian's hand. Ryan was asked about the motorcycle Brian was upset about. He said he knew that it belonged to a customer named Vance Dalton, a friend of his, who had purchased it from a man named Brian Flatoff. As far as he knew, he just thought it was getting fixed at the shop. He said he recognized Brian because Vance had shown him a photo of him and said he had been harassing him. At 8:50 a.m., the video shows Ryan on the phone. He said he believes that's when Brian told him to call Vance and tell him to get there. Meanwhile, Brian and ML were talking.
Were you able to hear anything that the defendant was saying, if anything, at this point in time to Michael Funk?
I think he was saying, you know, like, I'm serious, you know, this is really happening, and I believe ML said, yeah, we know you're serious, we're scared to death.
He was able to get through to Vance after a few tries.
And what did you say to Vance Dalton once he answered?
I believe he answered the phone and he said, yeah, I'm on my way. And I told him, don't come down here, call the police. I said, Flatoff is here with a gun.
He was asked if Brian made any statements about his gun.
I believe he said, I got 75 rounds of ammo and I'm here to get this done, or something. I can't exactly remember.
Did he have any other weapons on him besides the gun?
I only ever saw one other dagger. That was it. Or knife that he showed me.
Did he say anything when he showed you the knife or the dagger?
He said he believed, or I believe he said he was going to use it to cut Vance's ears off or something like that.
He said Brian had the gun out pretty much the whole time, waving it around and pointing at things with it. He said Brian shot the gun into the ceiling at one point and said, I'm serious. They again told him they know he's serious. He recalled Brian saying things like, this is a good day to die, and I want Vance Dalton down here. He said Brian realized his motorcycle was there, and so he told Ryan to get it off the lift. He wanted to put it in his truck. Brian then asked why Vance wasn't there yet. Ryan told him it would take him a while to get there, that he doesn't live that close.
Did the defendant do you recall him making any statements regarding what he was going to do to Vance, if anything, once he got there?
He said he was going to kill him once he got there.
Now, while this was going on, did you have an opportunity to escape out the back door while you were working on the bike?
I did, but he said if I go out the door, or if ML goes out the door, he'll shoot whoever is not. You know, if I run out the door, he's going to kill ML. If ML runs out the door, he's going to kill me.
About 10 or 15 minutes went by. He said he had taken the motorcycle off the lift and was putting it together by the back door when old Mike walked in through the door. He said he mumbled to get the fuck out of there, but old Mike just kept walking. He said he got as far as he could with putting the bike together and asked Brian if he could sit by the counter. Brian said yes, and so he went and sat down and smoked a cigarette. At some point, he saw the door open and the SWAT team's shield come through. He remembered hearing, police. He hit the floor behind the counter right away, but he didn't see anything after that. He assumed after the gunfire that the cops had shot Brian, but he thinks he remembers Brian telling ML to go close the door. He didn't see ML leave. He said he kept waiting for the cops to come around the corner, but that it never happened. In the video, you can see that smoke or powder has filled the room after the officers shot the fire extinguisher. ML has his hands in the air as he calmly walks to the back door and then escapes. Ryan said he heard another round of gunfire in the building, and then more gunfire that was now outside the building. It was 10:01 a.m. when Brian let them walk out. When he came out, he said he saw ML lying in the alley on his left.
When I stepped outside, I saw a blue truck by the garage door. I saw ML laying on the ground, not moving. And then I looked to the right, and that's where all the cops were. And they all had all their guns pointed at me and Mike Peterson. And then they all started shouting me to do 10 different things for everybody. So, and then they got me on the ground, put me in handcuffs, and put me in a squad car.
On cross, Ryan said he kept asking the officers what happened to ML and if he was okay. He said no one would answer him. He agreed that Vance is the one who told him that he bought the motorcycle from Brian. He didn't see the sale happen himself. Brian started to ask him if he had ever stolen a motorcycle from the shop.
Objection, Your Honor. We don't even need to finish this question. It's irrelevant, improper character, speculation, no foundation. And, Your Honor, this witness is a crime victim, and the law requires that he be afforded certain respects, whether the defendant's an attorney or not. There's a proper way to question, and just to throw things out there like this goes contrary to that law as well.
Right. So I'm going to sustain the objection, Mr. Flattop. That'd be other acts, evidence that would need to be approved by the court before being presented to this jury.
Ryan was asked if he was a member of the outlaw motorcycle gang called the Hell's Lovers. Again, the prosecution's objection was sustained. Ryan was then asked if he ever heard Brian making countdowns.
Did you ever hear me screaming, there's a 5-minute countdown or I'm going to start killing you guys?
Not screaming, but you said it.
A 5 minutes, I'm going to start killing you guys?
Yes.
Did you hear a 1-minute countdown or I'm going to start killing you guys?
Yes.
Did you ever hear me screaming that I'm going to kill Dalton and his wife and kids?
Not his wife and kids, no. And you weren't screaming.
Did you ever hear me say, I'm not going to hurt you? Brian asked. Not that I recall, Ryan replied. Special Agent Carroll with the Wisconsin Department of Justice interviewed Brian at the hospital. He said Brian was responsive and very willing to talk to them. He first asked him his name and where he lived to assess whether Brian understood the questions, and he responded right away. Brian told him that his motorcycle was taken by Vance Dalton, which was the core issue why he was there.
That was very, very upsetting to Mr. Flatoff. That precipitated him going there on that day with his statements of many times of having the full intentions of killing Mr. Dalton that day.
And he told you that many times throughout the interview?
Several.
Did he tell you at all why he picked that day in particular to go to Eagle Nation and kill Vance Dalton?
He did not have an answer for why that particular day. He had explained where he came from and that claimed that he didn't even really recall being there until the moment where he walked in the door and saw his motorcycle.
And what did he say he did, or what was his reaction if he gave it regarding when he walked in and or when he saw his motorcycle there?
In his words, he says he fucking snapped.
He said he asked Brian if he was intoxicated at all. And Brian said he had had some Smirnoffs earlier in the day. As for what he was planning on doing to Vance Dalton.
Now, did you ask the defendant anything regarding Vance Dalton and any efforts to get him to come down there that day?
I did. And he explained that he had attempted to get through the mechanic to get Vance Dalton down to the shop for the clear purpose of wanting to kill Vance Dalton.
So what did he say he was going to do after he was going to cut Vance Dalton's throat?
And then he was going to kill himself, shoot himself in the head, I think is what he said.
Brian also told him that he took a pipe to the motorcycle and destroyed it. He said he didn't want anyone else to have it.
Did he talk at all or make any admissions about pointing the gun at anybody while inside Eagle Nation?
He did. And we asked him if he pointed a gun at anybody. He said he pointed a gun at everybody.
Brian also described to the agent what happened when the police stormed in.
They asked him what happened when the police came in. He had said he heard a bang, got down behind a cabinet or a toolbox desk. There was some variation in what it was there. He wasn't quite sure. And then he indicated he just started shooting over the top of it.
Brian said he had his gun displayed the entire time. As to whether he knew if ML had a gun, he said he didn't see one. Agent Carroll told the court that Brian asked him if anyone had been shot. They told him they couldn't answer that.
And did the defendant make any statements after that?
He did. He was assessing the lack of blood and what appeared to be a method to determine if anybody was shot. And then he made some statements about with all the shooting going on, that kind of thing can happen, meaning somebody getting shot or killed.
On cross-examination, Brian asked him if he noticed whether Brian was drooling on himself when he interviewed him at the hospital. Agent Carroll said yes, he had drool on his face. Brian then asked him if he knew why he was taken to the hospital and not the county jail. He said he doesn't know. Brian also noted that there was about an hour and 15 minutes missing from the surveillance video from inside the motorcycle shop. There's a gap between 4:04 p.m. and 5:34 p.m. Agent Carroll said he didn't know why that was. He said when he collected the digital evidence, it did not appear to be tampered with.
At the hospital, the medical professional told you I had a BAC of 0.12. Do you recall that?
I do.
Is there a reason why you look at the district attorney when you're answering me?
Wondering if he's going to allow you to testify from there and me answer to it.
Were there any other drugs or medications in my blood work?
I don't remember reviewing any documentation of your blood work.
On redirect, the prosecutor asked about the hour and 15-minute gap in the surveillance video. Agent Carroll said that during that time, he was interviewing Brian at Mercy Hospital, and that a crime scene or law enforcement walkthrough was likely occurring during that time frame. Agent Carroll also said that Brian was lying down in his hospital bed when he first came into the room, and that Brian sat up right away. It seemed as though he had just woken up, and that could account for the drool on his face. After Agent Carroll's testimony, the state rested their case. Before Brian started his case, he asked the judge if his standby counsel could now take over. He said he's done the best he can, but now his standby counsel, Ben Slodgy, would be more effective. Slodgy, who had been sitting next to Brian during the length of the trial thus far, told the judge that he has severe reservations with taking over the case, including the fact that he didn't agree with Brian's opening statement. But he said if the court orders him to, he would do it. The judge said he would have to contact the public defender's office and get them in on the decision too. But in the meantime, Brian began calling witnesses and asking them questions himself. Special Agent Steve Lewis was one of his first witnesses. Brian asked him all sorts of questions about Agent Lewis's interviews with various officers. At least three of them, Agent Lewis didn't interview himself, so he was unable to answer the questions. Brian then tried to ask if he knew about a conversation between one of the officers who shot Michael Funk and another one, but the prosecution objected and the judge called it double hearsay and sustained it. Brian ended his questioning of Agent Lewis. Next up, he called Special Agent Dunlap to the stand. He asked him if he did a walkthrough of the scene with Officer John Kufel at around 4:20 on December 5th. He said yes. Were search warrants on site? Brian asked. Agent Dunlap said he didn't know. Brian then asked if there was a police association attorney present, and he said yes. The judge asked Brian what the relevance was for this line of questioning. Brian said that seven Neenah police officers walked through the crime scene without a search warrant, and that video evidence of that walkthrough has been deleted. Brian then asked Agent Dunlap if the Department of Justice was in any way involved with the 2012 $50 million lawsuit. The prosecution again objected as to relevance, and the judge sustained it. Brian then questioned Agent Kira Shellhorn, also with the Wisconsin Department of Justice. He asked her why a certain Neenah police officer, Officer Adam Struggle, went to the crime scene. She said Officer Struggle helped in certain technical areas, and that he retrieved electronic evidence from the scene, including the surveillance video and squad car video. She was asked if she was ever advised about issues with surveillance or squad car video. She said it took a while and a couple different analysts had to access it in order for them to view it, but she didn't know of any issues. Agent Jake Vosters, another special agent with the Wisconsin Department of Justice, was also called to testify for the defense. Brian asked him why, 2 days after his initial interview of Officer Ty Thompson, did he then go and question him again, this time about how many magazines he had on him that day. Agent Vosters said he wanted to ask Officer Thompson how many rounds of ammo he commonly keeps in his magazine. It's a 15-round magazine, and there was only 14 rounds in it when Officer Thompson turned the gun over. He said Officer Thompson told him that he keeps only 14 for the integrity of the magazine and because they last longer that way. Brian then tried to ask him if Officer Thompson told him that he knew who Michael Funk was when he helped retrieve his body. The prosecution objected, and the judge ruled that it's hearsay and couldn't come in. Brian asked if a gunshot residue test was ever performed on Officer Thompson, and Agent Vosters said no. He said he didn't know if his gun was tested. After Agent Vosters' testimony, the jury left the courtroom, and the judge addressed some issues with Brian and the prosecution. He asked Brian why he kept bringing up the $50 million lawsuit and what the relevance of it was. Brian explained that he thought there were many parallels between that lawsuit and this case. He said there were reports that back in 2012, when the Neenah Police Department raided Eagle Nation, that the officers tampered with the system too and allegedly planted drugs. He said he didn't know if the reports were true or not, but that there was definitely a history there between some of the same officers and even the same district attorney and the witnesses in this case. He noted that there were current and active investigations going on at the time of the shooting. District Attorney Seaman told the court that they can't have a trial within a trial and that all other acts must be discussed prior to trial, and that hasn't happened here. The judge ruled that there would be no more talk about the lawsuit. He then asked Brian about something else he kept bringing up, Officer Hoffer's statements after the shooting. Why is that relevant? He asked.
On several occasions immediately after the statements he made, the laughing about you talking with Officer Zules, they were bragging about, yeah, we got one right between the eyes, right? You know, there's one of them that says that, one of them right in the headlights, one in the noggin. One of us, we both unloaded on them. The statements of fuck that, let them lay there and die. I could care, there was never any express concern, even if they had believed it was me, that you would expect that they shot and killed a human being.
The judge said that if Officer Hoffer did express a lack of concern, that it does have a degree of relevance, so it could come in. The last issue was about whether Ben Slodgy would be taking over the case, as Brian was now requesting. The judge warned Brian that if he grants that request and lets him waive his right to represent himself, he will lose control of the case. They can call some witnesses or no witnesses, the judge said. Brian said he understood and still wanted to move forward with it. And so Ben Slodgy became the lead defense attorney. But in the end, Brian, along with Slodgy, decided not to call any more witnesses. And so they moved on to closing arguments. The prosecution went first.
The defendant spent a good part of the last 4 days, beginning with his opening statement, and through his cross-examination questions, leveling a number of unfounded, unsubstantiated, inadmissible accusations at the victims in this case, the witnesses in this case, the police officers in this case, all with one purpose, one goal, and that was to direct your attention anywhere but here, and anywhere but here, where witness after witness came forward here during this trial and presented you with the overwhelming evidence of the defendant's guilt of these charges.
Prosecutor Seaman said Brian intended to kill not only Vance Dalton, but the police officers too. He shot Officer Hoffer in the head, he said. That bullet would have gone straight through his right eye had it not been for his helmet. He said Brian came armed for a shootout with 66 rounds of ammunition. He then played a phone call between a hostage negotiator named Kathy with the Neenah Police Department and Brian during the standoff. This is the moment when ML makes his escape.
Close that back door. Close the back door. Close the back door.
Sir, can you hear me? Sir?
Hold on, he's closing the back door right now. If you fucking run out that back door, I'm gonna fucking unload on you.
Sir? Can you please talk to me for a second? This is Kathy. I'm from the Neenah Police Department.
The first round of gunshots was Brian shooting at ML. The second was the police shooting at him. ML was never released, Prosecutor Seaman said. Brian tried to keep him inside by shooting at him after he had just got done shooting at the police.
Moments after the cops now are already all jacked up because they've just been fired on. After they were forced by the defendant, forcing their hand to scramble together a hasty team and try to make entry into Eagle Nation to try to save these people because of the five-minute countdown handed down by the defendant. When the police tried to enter, he didn't just fire one shot at them. He released a barrage of gunfire to the point that they thought maybe they were being ambushed.
He said Michael Funk was armed, and we can't speculate as to why he never shot Brian. We'll never know, he said, but he only pulled out the gun after Brian shot at him. Ben Slodgy gave the closing arguments on behalf of Brian. He said this is no doubt an emotionally charged case. A man's life was lost, he said. A brother, a friend, a father, and people were hurt. He said it's not his common practice, but that he actually agrees with most of what Prosecutor Seaman said.
Brian is responsible for the majority of what has been alleged here. That, as you well know, you listened to the first 3 days of testimony in which Brian represented himself, and though the evidence was presented to him or witnesses were brought up, he made little to no effort to refute the state's accusations that he had violated bond while drinking, that he had armed himself, gone to Eagle Nation, that he made threats of people, that he had done these things that the state so dramatically explained to you, that he did, in fact, fire shots at innocent police officers as they came in, that he did indeed make threats. And those are things for which you can and should hold him accountable. As he made no effort, I think it shows at this point, that we concede that he is guilty of specifically all but two of the counts that are brought against him. Those are the count of conspiracy to commit first-degree intentional murder of Vance Dalton and the felony murder of Michael Funk.
He said Brian's behavior was not acceptable, but that it was not a conspiracy by law. As for the felony murder charge, he said just because we find someone's actions reprehensible does not mean we can convict them of crimes. The evidence has to show that the elements are there. He brought up the officers' testimonies and how they thought it was an ambush.
And that is relevant as the underlying offense for this count of felony murder is the false imprisonment of Michael Funk. You have to find as a jury that offense, the commission of that offense, caused the death of Michael Funk. That Brian Flatoff's commission of that offense caused the death of Michael Funk in order for you to find him guilty of felony murder. Now, the state is correct in saying that another word for cause is a substantial factor. So the commission of that false imprisonment was a substantial factor in the death of Michael Farmer.
But he said the gunshots don't equal false imprisonment.
And again, while we may find that act reprehensible, we may find it callous, a disregard for life, that is selfish, it is not, under the law, an appropriate basis for felony murder.
He said the jury can find him accountable in other ways, but not of the conspiracy to commit murder against Vance Dalton or the felony murder of Michael Funk. The state did not meet their burden in those two instances, he said. The jury deliberated for about 2 hours before finding Brian guilty of all 16 charges. At his sentencing, in which he again had no legal representation, the judge told him that public safety is at risk when he's free. He was sentenced to 100 years in prison, meaning he will likely never be released again. And that's all for this episode. As always, I'd love to know your thoughts on this case. Do you agree that Brian Flatoff was responsible for Michael Funk's death? Do you agree with the felony murder conviction? Do you think the officers should have been held responsible? Let me know by joining the conversation on Instagram at CourtJunkie, by tweeting me at CourtJunkiePod, or by emailing me at podcast@CourtJunkie.com. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.